Can you tell how many people are listening? Is it Terry on there?
I can, yeah. Here in Genesis chapter 9 is where we're at this evening. So they're all off the boat, and we see God giving man a second chance, a do-over, as it were. And Genesis 9:1, God blessed Noah and his sons, and said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. If you remember, the word replenish is also used the first time he talks to Adam and Eve, so it's not a restocking, but rather get out there and be fruitful and multiply. Also, if you remember back in when we saw the first time that God gave that command in chapter 1, verse 28, to replenish the earth, it was a kingdom setting. It was without sin. And the command was given, my Bible, I'm sure, has 128. That page hasn't fallen out yet. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish and the sea and the fowl and the air and over everything that moveth upon the earth. So, man was to have dominion over all things. And of course, that had to do with that was in a perfect setting. The other thing that was different at that time was that animals and man were not at odds one with another. In chapter 2, verses 19 and 20, God brings the animals to Adam and to see what Adam would name them. And, so the lions, tigers, and bears are my, God brings to Adam, and they're not trying to eat Adam, because God's bringing them to them to see if any of them would be a help meet for him. Of course, none were found to be such. But the animals were friendly, and they weren't carnivorous at that time. They all ate vegetation and whatnot. So you see the difference when Noah and the boys and their wives get off the boat. Sin has permeated and done its work on all of creation, not just man, but all of the creation. In Genesis 9:2, here, rather than the animals walking up to Adam and being friendly and with one another and with man, you see, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. So man still has dominion over them, but they fear man. And that's obvious. If you if you've ever gone out into the wild, wild animals naturally have a fear of man from the day that they're born. And if they see you, they'll run. So it's just a God-given instinct of self-preservation for them. They know that you're the hunter and that they're the hunted. So they'll take off and hide, and they'll avoid you if they can. Even the carnivorous animals, the lions, tigers, and bears, they'll avoid you at all costs. So things have definitely changed since the time of the garden. Another change is that all moving things are edible. God says that they're going to run from you, but if you can catch them, you can eat them. And Genesis 9:3, every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green of herb have I given you all things. So, if you had a hamburger and salad before you came to church this evening, it was just fine and dandy. And that's what Noah and his boys could eat also. So anything they could kill was fine to eat. But with one exception, God forbids the eating of the blood of the animals. He says, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. Now, it's interesting that same command is brought down all the way into Acts 15. Acts 15:28 and 29, the Holy Ghost gives James the command for Paul to, you know, a letter to take to Paul, for Paul to take to the Gentile churches, that they abstain from meats offered to idols and from blood, and from things strangled and from fornication. Not a whole long, you know, laundry list of things, but one of the things was that they should not eat blood. You know, and you think about that, and why would that be? Why would that be? Why? What is the thing about the eating of blood? Well, in Leviticus 17, starting in verse 10, God explains that blood was given for a sin atonement. You know, the blood didn't show up. You know, when the creation was formed, all the animals were friendly. You know, man was friendly with man. Man was friendly with the animals. There was no animosity, no fear between them, and so nobody knew anything about the internal workings of the body. There was no blood being spilled anywhere until a certain event, and that, of course, being Cain killing Abel. And that was the first blood that was spilled on the face of the earth. That was the first murder. Before that, until sin was committed in the garden, and then after that was given to man a atonement for sin. And you see that when Abel brings an animal sacrifice to God. And
God killed the animals, to cover Adam and Eve.
He killed a couple of animals to cover Adam. Yeah, we talked about that. He killed the animals, you know, to dress them. So there was an animal sacrifice made in teaching them that blood, you know, blood covers the skin or the sin. And then in chapter 4, verse 4, you see again, Abel making a blood sacrifice. So God taught them that blood is the atoning, the means of atonement for sin. And, you know, Cain brought vegetables, Abel brought an animal sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. And his sacrifice was accepted by God. So blood is a God-given thing. It is not something to be taken lightly. Originally, it was not to be. It was not something to be spilled. So the spilling of blood is only with the permission of God. Look at what it says in Leviticus chapter 17:10. It says, "And whatsoever man there may be of the house of Israel or the strangers that sojourn among you, that eateth any manner of blood, I will even set my face against that soul that eateth blood, and will cut him off from among his people." And then you say, well, why would that be? "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the soul." So it was given by God for a certain reason. God killed the animals to atone for the sins of Adam and Eve. God then put the animal sacrifice in place as an atonement for sin, and you saw that with Abel. "Therefore, I said unto the children of Israel, no soul of you shall eat blood, neither shall the stranger that sojourneth among you eat blood. And whatsoever man there be of the children of Israel, or the strangers that sojourn among you, which hunteth and catcheth any beast or fowl, that may be eaten, he shall even pour out the blood thereof, and cover it with dust. For it is the life of all flesh, the blood of it is the life thereof. Therefore, I said unto the children of Israel, ye shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh, for the life of all flesh is the blood thereof. Whosoever eateth it shall be cut off." Well, so it's really a sacred thing given by God. You know, the blood is not something to be taken lightly. Of course, Hebrews 9:22 said, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Covenants in the Bible are sealed by the shedding of blood. In Exodus 24:8, Moses, this is of course the Old Testament, the Old Covenant. Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words." The Old Covenant was sealed with the shedding of blood. We'll see another covenant here very shortly sealed with the shedding of blood. As we progress through Genesis, a covenant with Abraham will be sealed with the shedding of blood. So it means something. It's not just something to be taken lightly. So it is always, God places a meaning on the shedding of blood, the right words aren't really coming to me, but to dishonor the shedding of blood, I suppose, is that God doesn't take that lightly. There is another aspect to it. Here we have another command, and that's in Genesis 9:5. The spilling of blood. If someone takes another man's life, God says, when Cain killed Abel, what was the punishment for that? He banished Cain from the garden, and he sent him out. And Abel says, "Woe is me!" But and then he marks Cain and says, "No one can kill you. No one will be able to kill you, or else I'll take out revenge on him seven times." Now the rules change. God says, if someone kills another man, it's his life will I require. In other words, a life for a life. A life for a life. So Genesis 9:5 says, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require, and at the hand of man, and at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man." So, if you take the blood, if you take the life of another man, what you're doing is really taking the life of the image of God by your own hands, and God then requires the taking of a life for that life. The next thing God says, which is seemingly out of place but really isn't, is to be fruitful. Genesis 9:7. He says, "And you be fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein." He repeats that command. Like, Lord, didn't you already say that? Well, yeah, he did. But it's repeated again. And why is that? Why is that? Well, because God has just set out some rules that are really new rules. First of all, there's no eating of blood. Well, okay. Really, that probably hadn't been a problem before. I mean, not that we know of, but
weren't killing animals.
Up to this time, animals weren't supposedly on the diet. So, up to this time, it hadn't been a problem that we know of. Anyway, the Bible hasn't recorded it. Now, the punishment for a man's blood is another life. So it's a life for a life. We know of two other killings in the Bible up to this time. And God says the whole world was full of violence and wickedness before the flood. So we can figure that there was quite a few more than that. But now the rules have changed. And God then says, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply herein. Why then would that progression be logical to say, again, God as basis reiterating the new rules? Well, God knows what's going to happen. Remember, sin has entered into the world. We're no longer dealing with people in the garden in a state of sinlessness. God is dealing with 8 people in a state of sin, in a fallen state. And people in a fallen state generally fall even farther as time progresses. So all we can do then is look forward in the Bible and see what happens as time does progress and say, why did God say these things? Well, if the command is to be fruitful and multiply and bring forth abundantly, it's have children and have lots of children. That's really what God's saying. Have children and be abundant about the children. So God, that's what the command is. Well, as you look forward, the offspring, which are God's people, are, you know, when they come to what is the promised land. I mean, this is where Noah's really getting off the boat. What was promised to him. This is God fulfilling his covenant with Noah. God promised to keep them safe through the time of wrath and has done that, and now the boat has landed, and now this is the whole new world. God's finishing his promise to Noah and saying, get off the boat and go and enjoy the world, and here's the new deal. And be fruitful and multiply. Well, the same sort of thing happened with Israel. He brings them out of Egypt and says, I'm going to take you to a promised land. And when that eventually happened, he says, when you enter into this land that I have promised all the way back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you're going to go in there, but here's some things that I want you to do, and here's some things that I don't want you to do. And in Leviticus chapter 18, there's a whole lot of things that God says, I don't want you to do. And it's interesting, the things that God says, I don't want you to do, that deal with the multiplying of children and multiplying of the species. Here in Leviticus 18:3, what God warns them not to do is, after the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do, and after the doings of the land of Canaan. Well, the land of Canaan, as you'll find out pretty soon, is the offspring of Canaan, which is the son of Ham, one of the kids that gets off the boat, and the son of Noah. But so they're the offspring and the descendants of Canaan. After the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do, neither shall you walk in their ordinances. So God says, I don't want you to do the same things that they're doing. Well, if you continue to read Leviticus 18, it's astounding the things that God says. He says, I don't want you to have, it's all about incestuous relationships. I don't want you to go after your sister and after your mother and after your dad's brother and your dad and all these relationships. Why? Because they're not really good for being fruitful and multiplying and bringing forth abundantly in the earth. They're counterproductive to that, aren't they? And then we get down to Leviticus 18:19. And here's even further counterproduction. It says, and thou shalt not approach unto a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is put apart for her uncleanness. What is that uncleanness? It's the woman's monthly time. And she can't get pregnant during that time. And so God says, guess what, boys? You're going to have to put it away during that time. Why? Because you're not going to be procreating and getting her pregnant. So there's no reason to be, laying with her in the first place. It's counterproductive to being fruitful and multiplying. Moreover, verse 20, thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife to defile thyself with her. No one wants to have a baby with a neighbor. That's the last thing you want. Verse 21, and thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech. In other words, don't kill your children sacrificing them to the false god Molech. That's what was going on with the Canaanites and the people who lived in that whole region. They were sacrificing their children. How counterproductive being to multiplying the human race is that? Neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. Neither shall I lie with mankind as with womankind. It's an abomination. How many gay couples do you know that have ever had a baby? None. Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself wherewith. Neither shalt thou any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion. How many women have ever gotten pregnant by a dog? None. Because it's physically impossible. God says these things are an abomination. They're counterproductive. Yeah, I get ugh and gross on there as comments. Well, it is ugh and gross, but the fact of the matter is these are the things that were going on in the Egyptian nations and the Canaanite nations, and God says, don't do these things. The reason is because the command is to be fruitful and multiply and bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. And then God says, defile not yourselves in any of these things, for in all these things the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. In all these things. So as you read the list, as abominable and disgusting and gross as they may be, they were going on. All these things are going on. And you think today that people are defiled and demented and sexually perverse. All these things have been going on for thousands of years without the internet. So that's why God says, don't drink blood. Don't drink blood. Because that's one of the things that these people did. That's one of the things that these people did. I told you guys before I got started that I looked in Usher's Annals of the World. It's a huge book, but on pages 150 and 151, I just wrote down this little bit about it. It's regarding the summer of 446 B.C., and I'm not even sure if I can pronounce these names, but it talks about the death of Themistocles, who had been made the general of the Persians. And it talks about the various controversial reports about his death. And it says first that Themistocles died a natural death at Magnesia. That's where they made milk, by the way. But at Magnesia. Others say he poisoned himself voluntarily when he saw that he could not subdue Greece as he had promised the king. Then it goes on to report that Eusebius, now Eusebius, of course, that should ring a bell. He was a historian, noted that Themistocles died from drinking bull's blood. Valerius Maximus gave us more details when he said he appointed a sacrifice at which he drank a full bowl, a bowl full of bull's blood. Hence, he fell dead before the altar as a noble sacrifice of piety. So memorable was his departure from this life that it effectively meant that Greece would never need another Themistocles again. Also, Cicero had Pompeius Atticus tell of his death in this way. These men wrote of him that had sacrificed a bull. He drank its blood from a basin and died in that place. Aristophanes stated that Themistocles died from drinking bull's blood. It was common practice. And these are the Gentile pagan nations of the world. God could foresee what was going to go on. The drinking of bull's blood and things of that nature. And God says, don't partake of the things that go on by the Egyptians and then the Canaanites and all the Gentile nations and who worship after false gods and after false deities. Blood is for an atonement sacrifice. It's not to try to garner the life force of a bull into your own body. And that's exactly what was going on there.
Try to get strong, you say?
Yeah, try to get strong. That's exactly right. You know, even today, people go out deer hunting. People go out deer hunting. And it's a common ritual when someone kills their first deer to cut out the heart of the deer and to drink blood from the heart of the deer in order to partake of the spirit of the deer. That's a common ritual among deer hunters today.
I've heard of cultures in different parts of the world that say kill a lion in Africa or something, and that would be a heart.
Yeah, that's right. Kill a lion and eat the heart. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And you know, you're becoming one with the spirit of that animal. It's nothing but pagan worship. That's exactly right. And God says don't do it. God says don't do it. So as we progress in Genesis chapter 9, we get to verse 8, and God makes a covenant with Noah and all flesh. Now, this is This covenant is made by the shedding of blood, of course, because the prior diet was a vegetarian diet. In chapter 2, Genesis chapter 2, verse 16, the diet was strictly vegetarian. All the things of the trees, the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat. That, of course, except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But now he has updated that and said, anything that moves, if you can catch it, go ahead and eat it. So the shedding of blood is the sacrifice. Man provides that sacrifice, you see, by the shedding of blood. And so this covenant is sealed by the shedding of blood through that sacrifice. And God spoke unto Noah, verse 8, and to his sons with him, saying, and I, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, and of every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. Now, this is a two-part covenant. One, all flesh will not die by the waters of the flood, and the earth will not be destroyed by a flood. God says, I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood. Neither shall there be any more a flood to destroy the earth. Now, we talked about this in a prior week. Was all flesh killed? Was all moving flesh killed by the first flood?
That was not in the oceans.
Yeah, those fish survived.
Yes.
Yeah. Fish survived. We have seen in the previous weeks that Noah and the ark and everything that happened surrounding it was a picture of Daniel's 70th week. It's just a perfect picture of all those events surrounding Daniel's 70th week. And there were survivors of Noah's flood. The fish that swam in the sea. God makes a covenant that all flesh will not die. And that's going to be the case. We see that out in the 1,000-year millennial tribute, you know, after the time of tribulation, there will be nations on the earth. There will be people on the earth outside of the city of God, outside of the New Jerusalem. Somebody has to be here. Somebody has to be here in order for that to be the case. So, you know, if God kills everybody, there's not going to be anybody left. You know, like I was talking to Betty prior to the lesson starting, and you know, you can read all kinds of different commentaries and kinds of opinions and what have you. You know, commentaries has every, you know, God killing everybody on the earth and it just being a wasteland for 1,000 years, and Satan and his angels being trapped on earth roaming around for 1,000 years down here while we're up in heaven in the New Jerusalem looking down kind of laughing at them. You know, that's not what the Bible testifies to. So, you know, the flood was a type of that which is going to be again. And there were survivors. There was flesh surviving through the flood in the form of fish. And there will be again. All things will be next time destroyed by fire. Of course, 2 Peter 3:10 through 12, the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. In which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with a fervent heat. That's a lot different than a flood. Yeah, the earth also and the works therein shall be burned up, seeing all these things shall be dissolved. What manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. So, you know, there's quite a different change from a flood. It will be a little warmer than that. But, you know, so God gives a clear indication of how things are going to happen, and He will keep to His promise. You know, we're not going to have another flood, but we will have, in fact, a new earth at some point. God gives a sign of His covenant, which He made with not only Noah, it's commonly called a Noahic covenant. But the fact of the matter is that it's made with not only Noah, but with the boys, and with all people, and with all animals, too. So, it's not only, you know, it's not just Noah. But that sign is, in fact, that of a rainbow. You know, as a...
The militant gay movement in Shanghai, that rainbow.
Yes, I know that rainbow is being used for a lot of other things these days, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. But God said in verse 12, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations." I do set my bow in the cloud, and it should be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. So you see that the covenant is not just with Noah, it's between me and with God and the earth. "And it shall come to pass, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh, and the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth." And God said to Noah, "This is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth." So, as strange as that may seem, you know, every time you see a rainbow, that's exactly what you're seeing, is that sign of a covenant that's been around for a long time in God's promise not to destroy the earth, you know, with another flood. But like I say, Peter makes it clear that the earth is going to be destroyed by fire. You know, when you read those verses, by the way, in 2 Peter chapter 3, that it talks about the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The day of the Lord is not just one day. So that time of the day of the Lord, don't think that as soon as the Lord shows up that the earth is going to melt away and all things are going to be destroyed at that, in a 24-hour period. So don't be confused about that. It still leaves time for a 1,000-year millennial rule and reign of Christ. And the Bible still teaches that clearly. And whether you're looking in the Old Testament or the New Testament, it's clearly delineated and clearly taught. So to say it's not, or to try to spiritualize it, Steve gave me a book that it's called Historicism, thank you very much. Historicism, where the 1260 years have already occurred, and amillennialism has the 1,000 years. It's very spiritualized and beginning with the ascension of Christ, and to say that that's not a literal 1,000 years, believe it not. When the Bible says 1,000 years, it is. So And the events surrounding that 1,000 years, the two resurrections are clearly taught, one at the beginning of the 1,000 years, one at the end of the 1,000 years. So until we get to the first resurrection, which is is accompanied by the meeting of the Lord in the air, that the 1,000 years hasn't begun until that time. So to say that it's already begun, or we're already in it, anything else, or that to try to spiritualize it away in any other way is just sheer foolishness. Meanwhile, as far as the descendants of Noah goes, obviously we're all descended from Noah, and we're all descendants of his boys in one way or another. One of the things that we are going to have to try to avoid in the coming chapters is to try to assign especially race to one boy or another. That's one of the pitfalls that people generally are going to fall into as they look at Shem, Ham, and Japheth. One of the common errors that is taught as Shem, Ham, and Japheth are addressed is that Shem is the Oriental people of the world, or those type of people of the world. Ham are the darker skinned people of the world, and Japheth are the Caucasian people of the world. And that is just an error which is unconscionable, really, to try to derive that from the information in the Bible. There is no such information. We can discern some things. We can, especially because we can follow the Lord's bloodline, being descended from Shem. We know where many of the descendants of Ham end up, and so we can discern some things from them. We can also figure out some of the descendants of Japheth, but to say and generalize all people and races from these boys is just a ridiculous assumption, and we're certainly not going to go there. There's also other assumptions that are made, and as we start Genesis, this section of Genesis chapter 9, let's read a few verses. And the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. Now, Ham being the father of Canaan, if you remember that one of the things that we found out was that when Israel entered into the land of Canaan, that God did not care so very much for the Canaanites, And so the descendants of Canaan were a very ungodly people, and Leviticus 18 delineates many of the things that they were doing. So we do know that many of the descendants of Canaan, who is the son of Ham, who is one of the three boys of Noah, were a very ungodly sort. So that can be said quite confidently and without any doubt. Having that in mind is going to shed a lot of light on the coming events, and so we'll read on and talk about the coming events. Verse 19 says, "These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread." So everybody alive today is the progeny of one of these three sons. Now, as it turns out, Noah is found not only drunk, but laying naked in his tent. A state where many of us have been before, not necessarily in a tent, but I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening right now can probably relate to. Now, the following events, though, are interesting. What happens is Noah began to be a husbandman. In other words, he was a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine and was drunken, and was uncovered within his tent. Now, that's all that's said by Moses as he wrote Genesis about what Noah did. So as you notice, Moses pretty much took the high road concerning what Noah did. He doesn't say that it was a good thing that Noah got drunk and laid down in the tent. He doesn't say it was a bad thing that Noah got drunk. He doesn't pass any judgment on Noah. All he does is state the facts of the matter. Noah grew grapes, and he made some wine, and he drank too much of it. So he went to his tent, took off his clothes, and laid down, because it was probably a hot day, and passed out. It's the next events that have been called into question over the history, and there's probably as many opinions as there are preachers. The next event is that Ham goes into the tent and sees Noah laying there naked. And we'll read the verse, "And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without." So Ham goes into the tent, sees his father naked, and the next thing that Moses says is that he told his two brothers outside of the tent that Noah was naked. So all seems well at the moment. And the next event that's recorded is verse 23. "And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness." So Shem and Japheth walked backwards and kept their face turned away from their father and covered up Daddy Noah without looking after Ham had come out and said, "Daddy's naked," in there laying drunk. Now, the next thing that's recorded is Noah wakes up in verse 24. "And Noah woke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him." Now, from that, the imagination can just run wild. The imagination can just run wild. And frankly, I suppose with good reason, because when you read Leviticus 18 and all the things that the Canaanites are doing, there's all kinds of things that aren't left to the imagination in that particular verse. But let's look at the facts of what went on. Ham walks into the tent and sees Daddy naked and drunk on the floor. And then he goes outside and tells his two brothers. Daddy is inside there drunk and naked on the floor. Let me ask you this first. Obviously he didn't know Daddy was naked when he walked in. So what would have been the proper thing to do when he did walk in and find Daddy laying naked and drunk on the floor?
I think he just turned to walk out and say a word about it. And then wake up and put his clothes on when he's ready.
Okay. Either walk out and not say a thing about it, or cover him up and then...
He's in his tent. I'm assuming he's had privacy.
Or somebody else could walk in and discover him. He could have covered him up and then walked out, not said a thing about it. But instead, he decided to take it upon himself to first not cover him up, and second, to go out there and tell his brothers, guess what? Daddy's drunk and he's laying naked in the tent. And so the brothers, Shem and Japheth, they take the high road in the story, don't they? They get a coat and they put it upon their shoulders between them, working together, and they walk backwards so that they don't have to see their dad naked, and they lay the coat over Daddy Noah on the floor and cover him up in case anybody else walks in the tent, then Noah won't be exposed to the world, and then they walk out. Now, what the story doesn't say is who else was around. But what we do know is that Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. But what we don't know is how much time or what events went on between the time that Noah awoke and when he found out what his younger son had done unto him, or what it was that his younger son had done to him. But what we need to assume is that from the evidence here, since Moses doesn't say anything else, is that once Noah woke, he walked outside the tent and found out that Ham had not only told his other two brothers, he had also spread it to everyone he knew that Daddy was laying drunk naked in the tent. And Noah probably heard that from someone else, that Ham went around telling everybody that you were laying drunk naked in the tent. You know, people like to gossip, don't they, Mike? And if you've ever done something wrong, sooner or later, it'll get back to you, won't it? Yeah. After it gets around to everybody else, sooner or later, it'll get back to you. And so Noah found out what Ham had done. Rather than just laying something over his dad, walking out and keeping his mouth shut, and not telling everybody that he knew about what was going on, he had to tell the whole world about what was going on. Remember, one of the things we don't know is how much time has gone on since the time they got off the boat in this event. Because, remember, there's an addition. Ham is the father of Canaan by this time. There's been at least one birth. There's some time gone by. Noah has been busy as a farmer, a husbandman.
And a grow grapes, so there had been season.
Yeah, there's at least been a year. I mean, I've grown grapes before, or not personally grown grapes, but I've seen grapes being grown, and you stick them in the ground, and they take a couple years before they even start producing any grapes. So, you know, you're talking about a year or two later. And so there's been some time go on. And so you can figure out that this is not just the next day. Well, maybe there's only 8 grown-ups on the scene. But nonetheless, Ham didn't handle the situation right, and he went around telling everybody. For all we know, Canaan was by the time this happened, Canaan was old enough to talk. Canaan was his grandchild and old enough to understand that Noah was laying in there drunk when Ham told him that.
His daughters-in-law might have been around, but that would have been inappropriate to discuss.
Well, and those were the other people that he would have told, the daughters-in-law. That's exactly right. So, Noah probably didn't appreciate so very much the indiscretion of his son, Ham. Knowing what kind of person Ham is, then, it's just like today. When you meet somebody and you find out what kind of person they are, and you find out, for instance, that they're irresponsible and they live life in a very irresponsible way, and they don't handle money, and they're ungodly, and you've met people like this, and you think, boy, if they ever have children, I feel sorry for those kids. And then it turns out they do have children, and your worst fears come true, that those kids are just like their parents or even worse. And then comes the next generation, and it just, does it get better, Mike, or does it get worse? It always gets worse, doesn't it? It always gets worse. Noah didn't put a curse on the one who did it, which was Ham. One of the things that Noah knew, and probably prophetically, was that his children would if Ham was had a very lax morality to him, his children would be even more immoral than he was. And then his children's children would become more immoral. And then that immorality would just generate and degrade over the generations and over time, until you get to the point where there in Leviticus chapter 18, you see God talking about they're even sacrificing their own children to the false god Molech, throwing their own kids in the fire as a human sacrifice, having sex with animals. Can you think of anything? Can you think of how farther south a civilization could degrade? And that is the offspring of Ham. Noah could. This is a prophecy then by Noah. When he, in Genesis 9:25, after he'd awoken from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan." That's Ham's son. "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." It's not so much a curse as it is a prophecy. It's not so much a curse as it is a prophecy. When you really think about it, because just like, you know, I explained to you a minute ago, you look at someone and you think, wow, you hope they don't have kids, because you know if they have kids, the kids' situation is going to be even worse than theirs. And if the kids then, you know, have kids, the grandkids' situation is just going to even be worse than theirs. And it's just going to get worse and worse and worse as time goes by. And that's exactly what Noah was saying. Cursed be Canaan, because he's going to turn out to be even worse than Ham. He's going to be a servant. He's not going to be a leader in this new society, this new world. He's going to be a servant. Because the fact of the matter is, his daddy is immoral, and he is going to walk in the footsteps of immorality, and it will increase. It will not decrease. And Canaan will be a servant of servants, shall he be unto his brethren. Have you ever noticed that oftentimes those people that are immoral and just in that state where you think, oh, boy, I hope they don't reproduce.
Yeah.
They end up being servants. They never prosper in life. They never do well in whatever avenue they take. And that's exactly what Noah was saying. A servant of servants will he be. He'll never amount to a thing. Shem, on the other hand, Noah said, will be blessed because of his relationship with God. And Noah said, blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. As long as Shem has a relationship with the Lord, he will always be ahead of and before Canaan. Canaan will always serve him. Verse 27, God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. Why? Because Japheth is blessed because of his relationship with Shem. Remember, who was it that took the coat and laid it on Daddy? It was the two boys working together. Now, when you think about it, what bloodline leads to the Lord? The Lord Jesus Christ. It's the bloodline of Shem. Blessed be Shem, the Lord God of Shem. And that's the bloodline that leads to Christ. Anyone that works with that and is attached to that, anyone who is hand in hand with Christ. You see, those two boys were a picture of the church, the body of Christ. As Paul says, the body is many members, but one body. And those two, joined together by that coat between them, together walk backwards. Not as two people, but as one. They walked and worked together. So as long as the two walked as one, they would always prosper. And Canaan, as long as he refused, would be the servant. The chapter ends with not the genealogy of Noah, that's in the next chapter, but really the death of Noah. Noah lived after the flood 350 years. That would put his life 2,006 years after creation of the world. 2,006 years after creation, or approximately somewhere around 1998 or around 2000 BC, when Noah dies. And all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So, quite amazing when you think about the length of Noah's life, the time of the flood. When you think about when these things happened, when you think about in relation to history, 2000, something that might have happened in history in 2000 BC. In secular history, that's when Noah died. So, the other societies were just going to be getting started at that time, and that's the reason why. Because the flood had just, 1656 was when the flood happened. In the year 1656 after creation. 1656 years after creation. So, from there, then things progress out. So it's an amazing story that secular history matches up perfectly with that of creation. When you go back to date those things which happened, it's astounding. But secular historians don't always agree. Exactly right.